Hey there, and welcome to Speakeasy with Kendra Fisher. Join me each week as my guests and I take a deep dive into all of the conversations we've been taught are better left unsaid. No more silence, no more hiding. This is a safe space where anything goes. Mitch Gourley, my friend, it is about time. I've been trying to sit down with you to have this chat for a while. How are you doing?
Doing fantastic. I think, as I mentioned before we hopped on here, I'm fresh off a sleepless 24-hour shift. So if there's any mumbling or Freudian slips, I apologize in advance, but we're going to try our best. So let's see what happens.
I'll do my best not to take advantage of the fact that you might not be at your best then, but I for some reason, don't foreshadow any issues with that.
It's funny you say that, though, because my wife says the sleep-deprived version of me is quite entertaining. So maybe it is my best. I don't know.
Oh, I'm all for this. So we'll see. I'm going to see if I can't get her on text quick while we're talking. And I'll see if she's got any keywords that I should know about. Get you out here dancing or something.
She's very preoccupied. You're organizing the mason drawer cupboard in our kitchen. So you might not get a hold of her.
I mean, it's a thing. Do you use them for it's for spices, right?
Spices, chia pudding, I don't know, whatever. It's like every time we buy a glass jar, it doesn't leave the house. It stays here. So
I'm
sure she'll find some use, or the pile will just continue to grow.
You can always find use for a good glass jar. But we'll save our crafting discussion for next chat.
Perfect.
This time around, first off, I mean, it never does any justice for me to introduce my guests, because at the end of the day, you're going to do that far better. So just share with everybody out there a little bit about yourself and what you're doing with your life these days, and then we're going to dive right in.
For sure. So as Kendra mentioned, my name's Mitch. I've been a career firefighter for the last 8 years of my life. And that kind of is where my world sort of revolves around nowadays, not only as a professional, but also in a coaching capacity and through the platform I have, which is Everyday Heroes, where I empower first responders to prioritize their physical and mental health, things that are both near and dear to both of us. So from a professional kind of work standpoint, I guess that's me. You know, I'm fortunate enough to be married to my lovely wife. I have an Aussie doodle named Joey, and I live in a small community about an hour and 45 minutes northwest of Toronto. So that's kind of Mitch Gourley in a nutshell.
And just to add to that, I mean, I had the pleasure of meeting Mitch. Actually, we worked together, and so I've known Mitch now a few years. And I think, I mean, beyond the fact, how old were you when you got hired on full time? You were like one of those, like, you started out of diapers, kind of.
Yeah, I definitely fell through the cracks, I guess you could say. I started as a volunteer firefighter literally on my 18th birthday. And then I started as a career firefighter in May of 2016 at the ripe age of 20. So it's kind of all I've ever known. I kind of laugh because my first job I ever had was at Walmart stocking the shelves in the dairy aisle. And my next job was fighting fires. So, I kind of got thrown into things right off the hop, but honestly,
it's the natural career progression.
For sure. But I'm very lucky that things kind of happened the way it happened. And honestly, everything I have today is thanks to the fire service. So very grateful for that.
And was that something you always wanted to get into? Was that like born and raised, you wanted to be a firefighter, or is this just something that kind of you picked up along the way?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've been fortunate enough to be on a couple podcasts, and that question seems to come up all the time. And I joke and say that I didn't really have a choice. There's a really great picture I can send you. My dad actually missed my birth because he was at recruit training with his father, who is his training officer. So I'm third generation. And like I said, there's that great photo of my dad holding me in bunker gear because he came directly from training. And knowing what we know now about bunker gear probably wasn't the best thing to be holding a freshly born baby in his arms. But I joke that, you know, the decision was kind of made for me at that point. The first fabric that my fresh skin touched was bunker gear. So I think at that point it was kind of set in stone. But in all seriousness, Yeah. But in all seriousness, you know, just growing up around the fire service, having a dad who is a firefighter, having a grandfather who is a firefighter, it was always at the forefront of my, you know, brain and something I was just immersed and surrounded by at a very young age. And just with my personality, growing up playing team sports, it was just such a natural fit. So,
and I think that's huge. I think that's kinda huge. And I think we see a lot in terms of athletes and athletic minded people who find a natural kind of transition into the fire service for that reason, that team environment. But you are somebody who has really kind of taken it that much further. And this is a lot of what drew me to you as a person. And I think probably was the basis of, you know, kind of forging a relationship outside of the fire hall. And when I say that, I mean, I have absolutely, I'm happy to say that you're my trainer, you're my fitness trainer. And you've kind of been on this journey with me back to wellness. Mm-hmm. Speak to me a bit about kind of your mentality around fitness in the fire hall, because I think one of the things I appreciate about you so much and that I want to get into is that whole firefighter wellness versus just fitness. But mm-hmm. what's your progression been? Because I mean, you're coming into fire, you're young, I'm assuming we're lifting heavy, getting big and getting ready. But I've watched the evolution of Mitch, and I've watched mm-hmm. the evolution of like where you were and where you are now. And I want to understand that a bit better.
For sure. I guess we can start with kind of my approach now. And I think it's my approach with sort of everything I do is I'm almost insanely passionate about every endeavor that I go after. I definitely jump in with both feet, both hands. I'm all in. So I think my approach with fitness is that obviously, I've been given a great responsibility. When people are having their worst day, they're calling me, they're calling my coworkers. And I take great pride in the fact that I want to make sure that I'm in the best physical and mental shape possible to be able to be that person for them. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's kind of always been my approach with anything I do, but especially with my approach to fitness in a firefighting capacity. But yeah, you know, I think there's been many seasons of fitness, many seasons of life for me. When I started, I was that 20-year-old guy just full of, you know, ambition and desire and, you know, hitting the gym, you know, hitting the weights. Definitely at that time was probably training more for aesthetics as a young 20-year-old guy that was, you know, working on the fire department, living in Toronto, just trying to live his best life.
I appreciate the honesty.
Yeah. And then things just kind of, you know, progress from there. I think I see this a lot in the people I work with, which is what you did in your 20s doesn't necessarily work as you age. And ultimately the shift changes from aesthetics to longevity and mobility and ability on the job. And that's kind of been the natural progression of fitness for me. So yeah, going from that typical sort of bodybuilding style of training where big chest and big arms was the priority to now focusing on mobility, core strength, flexibility, things that are ultimately going to get me through a 30-year career. So yeah, that's kind of been how things have transpired, and definitely still take that same approach of just wanting to commit myself to fitness so I can be the best and ultimately know when that call comes that I've physically prepared to do my job and those people can rely on me to, you know, perform my duties effectively.
So one of the things you just said, the best physical, but also mental state. And I think that's something that we don't talk about anywhere near enough when it comes to first response and
100%
preparation. And I mean, so for you, first off, what does that mean for you? Like when you say, I want to be in the best mental state for my job, what does that look like? How are you doing that?
Yeah, let's be honest. In the first responder community, in the first responder world, when we respond to emergency, basically you have all your cognitive mechanisms working against you. You're put in a ultra high stress environment where you're no longer using your prefrontal cortex. You're in that kind of reactive reptilian brain which can be really, really dangerous in a scenario where you need to be thinking big picture. So for me, mental fitness, mental preparation, doing hard things before the bell rings to make sure mm-hmm. that I can have that mindful approach of being able to step back, being able to take that deep breath, being able to slow things down, slow down the breathing, slow down the heart rate. And these aren't new concepts. Like, you look at box breathing was, you know, and I might be, you know, wrong in this, but my understanding is that box breathing was basically designed in the military for these precision, you know, marksmen and stuff to slow things down in these high stress scenarios. So, yeah, having that mental fitness and knowing what is happening in my body and how to respond correctly is so, so important. And that is ultimately work that needs to be done beforehand. If you're not preparing yourself in a mental capacity, I think you're putting yourself at a big disadvantage, and not only putting yourself in danger, but potentially you and the people that you're responding to. So that's what kind of mental fitness means for me from a very acute job-related standpoint. But then we can go into the more long-term health side of things, where ultimately you need to have mental fitness in order to be able to get through that 30-year career, in order to be able to process what we're seeing. I think one word that was constantly brought up when I first started learning about first responder mental health was compartmentalization. And I have a bit of an issue with that, because I think if we, you know, package this stuff up in these nice little boxes and bury them deep in our subconscious, I don't think that's really the goal. I think integration should be a word that we're throwing around a bit more, meaning we deal with what we're seeing. We might put it in a box, but then 3 days, 3 weeks, 3 months later, when we are ready and in a place, we can open that box, work through it, and let it pass through us. Because, you know, we can go on and go down a big rabbit hole here, but suppressing and bearing that stuff down can manifest in so many unfortunate and unhealthy ways. So yeah, that's kind of my, I guess, job related and more longevity related, you know, approaches in regards to speaking about mental fitness. And then forget about being a first responder and a firefighter. You know, the everyday individual needs to have these tools, because outside of the job, I have family stress, I have relationship stress, I have all the other stresses that everyone has. So whether you're a first responder or not listening to this, you know, mental fitness is hugely important for anyone.
Yeah. And so you've touched on, I'm going to pull this apart now, which I love, because this is where it gets fun. So, I, first off, I think something that I know a lot about kind of your day-to-day habits and your practice. I'm one of the fortunate people who follows your ever-growing platform on Instagram and such. And also, obviously, I have some pretty direct kind of knowledge of how your program works, working with you in terms of all of the information you provide. And I can't say enough good. So yes, this is a completely unsolicited, like, if you are looking for somebody to work with from a fitness standpoint, absolutely, you need to go check out Everyday Heroes and period. Moving on. I kind of have an idea, because I understand a lot in the mental health space, but how would you suggest to people out there? So you're speaking about getting better at being mentally resilient and building on that before you're on shift. So what tools are you using beyond, you know, you mentioned box breathing, which is great for in the moment, but how are you building that resilience? What are you using in terms of tangible tools? Actually work on that.
For sure. So we'll get to that in a second, but I want to preface all of this with one thing that has been hugely important to me and kind of circles back to the fact that I've always been someone who is obsessive, you know, delves into things and just goes after things, is I think for so, so long, and I'm still working on it, and I will still be working on it for the rest of my life, but I was always trying to fix, and I felt like I had to do more, but it's this really funny, paradoxical thing, at least in my experience with mental health, is like, less is more. The more you try to fix, the more you try to resist and, you know, suppress and overwork and distract, it just makes things worse. So ultimately, I think acceptance and just learning to be with things, be with emotions, the good, the bad, the ugly. In the West especially, we've just been brainwashed that, hey, even as a young kid, stop crying, don't be sad, it's okay, you know, don't be angry. We demonize all these emotions, and then you grow up and as an adult, and all of a sudden we just want to push this stuff away, and we have all these vices and ways of doing that. Many of them are extremely unhealthy, and we just get stuck in that trap where, as I've grown as an individual and as I've grown, you know, with my physical health, my mental health, all that kind of stuff, learning just to sit with that stuff and stop labeling it and understanding that everything has its place, and also understanding that all the pain and suffering and anguish I've experienced has been this beautiful teacher and lesson. And if I were to not have been through or lived through that stuff, that I would be nowhere near where I'm at today. There's so much to be said about that. I'll definitely mention some tools, but I felt that that was important because we've always been told that we need to fix and do more. And this hustle culture that we live in nowadays, makes us believe that if we're not doing that, we're getting worse or we're regressing, but I don't think that's the case at all. In terms of tools, I mean, first and foremost, and this is why, you know, my presence online and what I do online is so near and dear to my heart, is because I think exercise is ultimately, you know, one of the best, if not the best way of, you know, being your best. Not only from, you know, an endorphin hormonal release aspect of improving mood, but just from a longevity, health and wellness aspect, I think exercise is definitely at the forefront in terms of my toolkit. From there, like you mentioned, breath work is something that I try to implement throughout the day. I wouldn't say, you know, I'm a busy individual. I don't necessarily have the time to sit on a mat in the middle of a day, but like even little tools, and a lot of people that are into the podcast space may have heard of Andrew Huberman before. He's a monster in this whole space, but
huge.
The one thing he always talks about is like the psychological sigh. So basically what that is a double inhale followed by a long exhale. So you basically inhale, try to fill your lungs up as much as you can, one more inhale, and then a long exhale. Doing little things like that when I know I'm feeling activated and stressed throughout the day can be really important. But if I do have more time implementing, you know, deep diaphragmic breathing, box breathing, all that kind of stuff, honestly, it's just like exercise. Depending on the day, I'll kind of change things up.
Just to add to that for 1 second too, it's even just giving yourself cues to make sure that you do it. I mean, I have alarms that go off and it's basically just like, okay, 1 minute right now, just breathe.
Absolutely.
And I think that the reason that's so huge to me is because breathing exercises, like you just said, they're really key for regulation. Mm-hmm. And so the problem is people try to learn these things when they're not regulated. And
absolutely,
that's detrimental. It's one of those things that when you practice it, when you're not stressed, when you're not in crisis, the likelihood of actually finding value in it during those moments is going to be much greater.
For sure. And not to be a cheese ball, but like me working in the space that I work in, I always use the example of like, we want the house to not be on fire. Like us trying to throw, you know, a fire blanket on the whole house that's on fire when it's already like, you know, it's a lost cause. If we can, like you said, use those tools when maybe it's a pot on the stove. Like that stuff's going to work, but it's an uphill battle if the house is already on fire. But
exactly.
Definitely agree with that. And honestly, one thing that I mention to people and I'll occasionally do on my Instagram stories and stuff is like just telling people, when is the last time you took a deep breath?
Yeah.
And there's people out there that I bet you could not tell you the last time that they consciously took a deep breath, which goes to show like if you're just living in that constant state of stress and, you know, one thing we have to understand about, you know, mental health and all that kind of stuff is like there's top down, you know, there's a top down mechanism involved, meaning if we're thinking negative thoughts, if we're thinking scary thoughts, if we're, you know, worst case scenario thinking, that obviously is going to have an impact on our body. But mm-hmm. what a lot of people don't realize, and this has been a, you know, a big area of study, is, you know, understanding the bottom up approaches and how much the feedback that our body is giving our brain can impact the way we think.
Exactly.
So if you're constantly living in that, like, you know, just chest breathing, your body is sending messages to your brain being like, we are in a state of activation and stress right now. This is not cool. Mm-hmm. So, you know, doing the cognitive work is important, but we have to do that other stuff. And, you know, that's why I'm such a big fan of exercise for that reason, breath work for that reason. And I think that's a perfect segue into, you know, another couple things that I like to use is like cold water immersion, whether that be shower or cold plunging is really, really important, because that has a reflexive kind of impact on your on your physiology, which can, again, that bottom up loop can be affected positively. We're getting all those feel good hormones that we love. Sauna is really great too. You pair those two together, a bit of contrast is absolutely amazing. I'm fortunate enough to have the tools at my house to do that.
Yeah.
And then last thing, you know, I'll be honest. And I think one thing I try to do online is just be 100% real and transparent. I don't sit down again on a mat in the middle of my room for a half hour a day and meditate. But one thing I do try to be very conscious of making a concerted effort to do is be mindful. And people get so confused because there's so much information out there of like, people don't even know what mindfulness and meditation is.
No.
But basically the way I try to tell people is I don't meditate every day, but I'm very mindful every day, meaning I'm constantly taking an inventory of how I'm thinking and adjusting that as I need. Sometimes that's easier said than done. Again, if I'm in a very activated state, it's really hard to get yourself out of that negative loop of thinking.
Yeah.
But if I can, and I notice that I'm ruminating or overthinking, being, again, mindful of that and aware of that, not necessarily even trying to change it, because again, we go back to that whole resistance and effort piece. You know, the more, if you tell someone who's having an anxiety attack or is overthinking to stop having an anxiety attack or stop overthinking, guess what's going to happen? It's going to get worse.
Get smacked.
For sure. But, you know, it's one of those things is like, if we're just aware and just, again, allow those things to pass, instead of me feeling anxious and being like, hey, I'm feeling anxious right now, it's probably because I got to go home and do this. It's probably because I screwed up on this. It's probably because I got to drive here. You're feeling anxious because your body's feeling anxious. You don't think anxious, you feel anxious. So people, again, going back to that whole like body mind approach, is people try to feel better by thinking more, but thinking doesn't solve the problem, because it's not a cognitive process that's happening. It's a somatic physical process that's happening. You just need to let that stuff move through. And it might be ugly and icky, but it's your resistance to feeling that ugliness and ickiness that is going to perpetuate it. Just trying to be mindful throughout the day.
And I think the other piece of that too, worth acknowledging, and maybe just for you to be more aware even, like you said, we have this kind of predisposed thought as to what meditation looks like. And you can meditate in a minute. And
100%.
It might not always go well. That's the reason it's called a practice. And there are going to be days that you try to meditate and you try to quiet, or you try to even just be aware of. And I think the key word that you used was conscious. Mm-hmm. If you are conscious of your surroundings, you are conscious of what you're feeling, you're conscious of your thoughts, you're meditating. And that can happen in a period of a minute. That could happen in a period of, you know, an hour. And people have this kind of thought of people sitting on a mat in this pleasant space where it's all very contrived. And at the end of the day, most people don't have the awareness or the ability to sit in that state for hours and make it useful. But I mean, there's a lot of those apps. Like, you look at the Calm app, you look at Open, you look at some of the different breath work modalities, and it's all guided. It's all helpful. But at the end of the day, you can have a really crappy meditation. But the fact that you consciously sat and tried to be aware and present, and like you said, let those feelings come and deal with the technical term of ickiness, then, you know, you're in a position where you're bettering your ability to manage those things and sit with them.
Yeah. And let's go back to this whole idea of like really trying to, you know, maybe explain these things through a different lens is, mm-hmm. if you went to the gym and said, I'm going to run on the treadmill for 2 hours today, but I've never ran, would you be disappointed with yourself if after 2.5 minutes, you're like, I can't do this? Same thing applies to what you're talking about. If you expect that you've never meditated or never even consciously, going back to people like, you know, take a second while you're listening to this and think of the last time you sat in a room for 10 minutes without looking at your phone, without trying to think.
Oh, it's horrifying.
Most people will say, I haven't done that in 30 years.
No.
So, you know, we need to understand that, like you were mentioning, this is a practice. It's going to be really, really hard. But the more
and
you do it. For sure. And one of the greatest things that I ever heard in regards to meditation or mindfulness or just being quiet is, if it feels really icky, again, if we're just going to roll with that, if it feels really icky and horrific, it means it's good. It means that you should be doing more of it.
Yeah.
So don't look at that. And you know, I have this has been something I'm really working on, is I used to always think of things as black and white. It was either, you know, a good outcome or a bad outcome. Mm-hmm. Same thing. I would go into meditation with this idea of like an outcome that I wanted. Yeah. And that is just, you're just, because like you said, there's going to be days when, you know, maybe you are able to get to that place of no mind and really quiet your mind and, you know, be conscious of your breath. But then there's going to be days that you just can't do any of that. And if you come out of that experience with this thought of, I'm a loser, I couldn't do it, now all of a sudden our meditation practice has actually added more stress and anxiety to our day. So, just again, radical acceptance. Your resistance to the way things are is anxiety in a nutshell. So
for sure,
just kind of go with the flow, roll with the punches, ride that wave. You're not going to beat the ocean. There's so many different, you know, analogies we could use, but
we just made a whole set of coffee mugs there. I love that for us.
100%. Some t-shirts, some merch. No, honestly, it's just, it's one of those things where, those are tools that I use just like anything, whether it's exercise. I mean, getting into a cold tub never gets easier. I'm just going to tell you that right now. But everything do, the more you do it, the easier it's going to be. And whether it's physical, mental, spiritual, whatever that may be, it does take time. It is a practice.
Well, and I think that that's the thing, right? I mean, and the beauty of those tools, and the reason I actually asked you specifically was for that reason, because at the end of the day, I mean, the gift that you have to offer the world of mental health, Mitch, if you haven't figured this out yet, is the fact that here you are, a fit young man who is, you know, in his, I'm not going to say you're in your prime, because you've got years of prime to go, I'm sure, and you'll make sure of it. But, you know, it's not easy. It's not easy to be a firefighter, to sit there as a guy and just be honest about this. Be honest enough to sit there and say things like icky or my pain or the grief or sitting through things or just sit with it or just feel it. Because a lot of guys, ultimately at the end of the day, and I'm sure that you get it from some, it's going to be a lot of pushback of, what do you mean just sit with it? Like, what do you mean? Like, come on. Man,
the one term that comes up all the time, and I kind of love it, because first, for those individuals that aren't ready to listen, I just call it woo-woo. Like, woo-woo is a very thing that's like, oh yeah, this might sound like woo-woo garbage, and I'm just gonna, again, throw that out there. So there's gonna be certain individuals that might, like, if I hear woo-woo now, I'm gonna be like, oh, okay, this is
I'm taking notes.
Let me pull my chair up. But there's either going to be people that hear like spirituality or woo woo, and it's going to be like, that's, they're going to hit the mute, like wherever the mute button is on my screen right now, I'm going to go ahead and hit that and just shut that stuff down. Yeah. But you know, one thing like you mentioned is like, it isn't easy, and it's really hard sometimes to get in front of a bunch of strangers and tell them that you've gone through X, Y, and Z. That'll never get easier.
You have feelings.
But one thing that I heard the other day that was like, speaking of all these, you know, lines and sayings and cliches, but this one just like floored me, blew my socks off. And it just, And it just resonated so deeply with me. And I think this applies so much to why I love what I do as a career, is it was, if there is one person in this world that is breathing easier because of my existence, then that's a win. And I don't care if 7.999 billion people think I'm an idiot and that they don't want to hear the noise coming out of my mouth. They can hit that mute button. But if there is one person, and I always say is like, if there was a Mitch Gourley out there when I was kind of struggling and like he was saying these things, how much that would have just made me maybe not even help, but just made me feel less alone. That would have helped so much. And that's honestly the approach I take now is whether it's one person, two people, 10 people that are breathing easier or having a better time, are navigating, you know, the struggles and the difficulties that come with this experience of being a human being, that are breathing easier because of something I said, did, mentioned, then it doesn't matter. You know, and then that's really it.
And that's so huge on so many levels. And I mean, I'm cutting you off here for a second, just because I can attest to this. I met Mitch, when I was starting as a firefighter. And I mean, it's humbling. It's humbling to walk into a fire department and have some 20-something-year-old kid giving you advice when you're already a mature woman who has children and is at a different stage in life. And you're sitting there trying to take it all in. And gratefully, I'm one of those people who accepted a long time ago, I don't know best. And I want to learn from everybody. I never want to be the smartest person in the room. I never want to have all the answers, because then I'm done growing and I'm done looking, and that's just not real. But I remember, and I don't know if Mitch will even remember this, but one of the first shifts I had, I was working with Mitch, and Mitch looked at me and said, some of the best advice I ever got, I'm going to tell you. And I said, what's that? And he said, only see what you have to see. And I said, you know, what do you mean? And he's like, you know, in this job, you're going to see a lot. And I'm somebody who has worked in mental health for a very long time now. So for me, I'm like, okay, this is rich. This like 20-something-year-old kid's going to give me mental health advice. But again, pride aside, let's listen, let's learn. And, you know, he explained to me that you're going to see a lot in this job, and you're going to see a lot in this life where, you know, the opportunity for you to fix or help is already passed. And to then accept that and accept that you don't have to engage and you don't have to witness and you don't have to sit in for longer for no reason, just to experience and just to, you know, get that badge of honor as a first responder of being the person who can deal with it all and tolerate it all. And I remember hearing that and thinking, you know, that's really smart. And there's been situations in my career already where, you know, heaven forbid, you're on scene and there's nothing more you can do. And instead of participating in ways that are set up to show everybody else that you can manage the worst of it and deal with the worst of it and just carry that all without actually seeking support or seeking some guidance. And I've always carried that with me. And I think that's what drew me to Mitch, so that when I got to this place in my life where I needed to reapproach getting back into shape, here I am now post-op. I'm not anymore, thanks to Mitch, but you know, rewind a month ago, I was probably in the worst shape of my life post-op and in a position where I really needed somebody who understood the woo-woo and the physical, because without one, I don't exist. The other doesn't exist for me. I can't separate these things in my life. And something that Mitch has always been really able to communicate to me, And I don't know if it's always been that way for you or not, but for me, I've always been able to take from you that you understood that there was more to it than just lifting a weight or going for a run. Mm-hmm. And so I have the utmost appreciation. I can assure you that you've already changed people's lives because of that, because I'm one of those people, and I appreciate you a whole lot for that, because I remember kind of touching base throughout the past couple of years being like, okay, Mitch, like, I'm going to have to get back in shape, but I'm going to have to get back in shape dealing with anxiety and dealing with a lot of grief. You know, my own life journey has been a little, and I need somebody who can really value both of those things. So you do that well, my friend. And it's, I think exactly what you're saying is, you know, don't accept other people's judgment, because you're making a difference. And if people don't want to hear it, you're right. Let them not hear it.
Absolutely.
But I think I love watching your journey. I love watching you grow. And I know that we've had these conversations off and on, you know, through work together. But one of the things too that you were talking about was that whole idea of compartmentalization. And I want to go back to that because I think that some people would argue as firefighters, you're on scene, there's some necessity to be able to compartmentalize in the moment.
100%. You have to be.
No, I just was going to say, I want you to explain that further because I have a pretty good idea in terms of where that sits for me. But I think what you're saying is so valuable and people need to be able to distinguish that.
For sure. Yeah. And it's one thing is like, you're an operator, you're a professional. Like when it's game time and, you know, as I say, like, you know, I am fortunate enough to work with a lot of great people. I'm with a really great crew right now. And when you go to the, when you're going to a hot call where dispatch is giving you, you know, updates, you know, I look at the person in the back and it's like, we're about to go to work. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying like, oh, can we do this? Oh, are we ready? It's like, I'm looking that man or woman in the eyes and I'm saying, let's do our job. Because although it can be challenging, I believe that I was put on this earth to do what I do, whether it be on scene as a firefighter or, you know, helping individuals. I think that's the synergy of both those things is honestly, you know, why I was placed on this earth, because I have such a passion for both things. But yeah, you have to be a professional. You can't allow those rational parts of your logic to cue in, because if you did, it would say, again, that cognitive part would say, excuse me, sir, you're going into a building that's on fire. Excuse me, sir, you don't know, you know, that car is upside down and there's hydro wires on the ground. Like, you know, you need to be able to do your job. But I think that's kind of the issue is a lot of people go into that work mode where they have to block it all out and do what they have to do, but then they don't appreciate what they just had to go through, what they just had to witness. Cause again, like you're doing things that 99.9% of the population doesn't do. So we need to work through that. We need to understand the magnitude of what we see and do and work through that. Because if we don't, again, it can cause all those issues. And it's just like we were talking about before, it takes time to find these tools and learn for you. For some people, having a very, you know, philosophical, emotional relationship with what they do might work for them. Yeah. For some people, you know, having that detached, whatever approach, that might work for you. What works for me might not work for the other person, but I started doing this when I was 18. I was cutting people out of cars while my friends were still playing, you know, Xbox.
Yeah.
You know, when my buddies were still playing Xbox. So I grew up really fast and almost too fast in some respects, looking retrospectively. But I basically had to figure out how to navigate all of this as a boy with no tools. Was basically thrown into the fire, you know, pardon the cliche, and I had to figure it out. And I went through, I would like to tell people that I made all these realizations by a bunch of great books and podcasts that I've read, but, you know, I spoke about this today, and it was like, the reason I got here is I went through the mud, man. I was knee deep in shit, excuse my language, but quite frankly, there was a time when I wasn't dealing with, you know, the things going on in my life well. I wasn't dealing with the things going on maybe in the job well. And one thing I do also want to reiterate to some of the people that maybe do work in the first responder world that are listening is I think a lot of my struggle was due to things that were outside of the job. So I think although it's important that we are talking more about mental health in the first responder community and trying to end the stigma, I also don't want to overemphasize the fact that the job is traumatic, because I don't want people thinking just because they get into this line of work that it's going to screw them up. I don't think that is the case. I think if you don't navigate, you know, things properly, that it can happen. But we just need to figure out what works for us, and it's going to take time and it's going to be ugly. And you have to realize that it's going to suck. But once you do work through those things, and once you do have those tools, it's just going to make it so much easier in the future. And that's the thing, is it's not going to change what you see. It's not going to make it any less terrible. It's just going to increase your capacity to navigate and deal with those things. So, just the school of hard knocks, you know, figuring it out, white knuckling it, for a little bit there. But and this is a true sign of healing, is if you can retrospectively look back at those times of, you know, suffering and frustration with gratitude and appreciation, because it's allowed you to be the person you are today, that's special. And I think people need to put in the work, for themselves. But ultimately I think people need to put in the work, because it's going to allow them to be, you know, Kendra 2.0, Kendra 3.0. There's so much growth and there's so much upside on the other side of, you know, being stuck in the mud. We got to remember that part too. There's great beauty in pain, and it doesn't all suck. You know, there's a lot of great to take from it.
Well, and I think I even go the other way with that. I mean, ultimately, I don't think that anybody in this world who has any kind of predisposition to achieving or being a high achiever or trying to attain a goal or anything of the sort, I don't think you get there without pain. I don't think you get there without hardship. And I think ultimately those are the things that do teach us, and those are the things that make us resilient, and those are the things that give us an ability to grow and learn what's truly important. And I think one of the things you said that I just want to go back to, because I do think it's so important, is that whole notion of what's caused by the job versus what existed outside of the job as it pertains to mental health. And I think something that's really, really important and relevant is this piece. You can't separate them. You know, you go to work as the person you are. You go to do whatever it is, whatever your vocation is in life. It just so happens that there's an extreme set of circumstances that come with being a first responder. But whatever you're doing in life, you're going into it with a foundation of who you are, a sense of self. And I think that if you're not working on that sense of self, or if you're using a vocation to try to maybe bury pieces of that or give yourself a different perspective of how you're experiencing things, you run the risk of then realizing that you're not able to ultimately, over the long term, which is, I think, key, maintain a sense of stability. And ultimately, you end up learning things the hard ways. And I think that's something that we do see a lot in first response, is people, unfortunately, accumulatively, the effect of life, the inability to maintain healthy habits, and not all of it trauma-based, but some of it just, you know, we work shift work. We work different hours. You just said it yourself. You're here on, you know, no sleep after, going hard all night. And those things accumulatively have an effect on us. And how do you then support that? How do you find it's best to help communicate that? Because I think one of the challenges with first responders is getting them beyond the job. It's really easy to accept when somebody says to me, you're dealing with mental health issues because of the trauma of your job. It's workplace injury. It's stress. It's trauma. That's sometimes easier to accept than somebody saying, I don't think you're managing your feelings very well. I don't think you're managing your emotions or coping or dealing with very well. And so how do you then encourage that?
Well, I'll speak to my experience and kind of why I wanted to reiterate that. And by no means am I dismissing, you know, anyone who's going through any hard time, and very well the job could be the sole reason for someone feeling a certain way, because there's people that have seen worse, done worse, been part of worse than I definitely have. And it's not about one-upmanship or who's had it worse, but, you know, I don't want to dismiss that fact. But what I will say from my personal experience is, you know, everything, I was one of those people when I grew up, when someone said they had anxiety, I would be like, what is this person talking about? Like, what does that even mean? And then, all of a sudden, I got into my early 20s and I think I started to experience, there's the stresses of life. And I was fortunate enough to never, ever get to the point of like panic or overwhelm. But like, I think there was just this unsettling nature of just generalized anxiety underneath the future. And I was just like, well, this doesn't feel right. Like, I don't want to feel this way. And then ultimately, going back to what we already talked about before, is that thinking part of your brain starts to say, well, they always say anxiety is, related, overthinking, catastrophic thinking is related to PTSD. Maybe it's the job. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh no, this thing that I love, that I identify with, like, could I be broken now? And going back to that narrative that was almost, pushed when I was going through school, it wasn't like, if you were going to get post-traumatic stress disorder, it was like, when you're going to get it. And I'm like, wait a minute, this doesn't sound like what I signed up for. So you start to, you start to think, and ultimately you start to almost create, you're thinking of the, okay, well, I did see that thing and that was really bad. And again, you start to almost manifest, or it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy that like, well, maybe it is work, but at least for me, like when I really started to pull back the layers and, understand my life before the fire service, the things going on in my life currently, is I think, quite frankly, the job definitely, and this is how I always describe it to people, is like, this makes up, and for anyone that's just listening, I'm basically making up a wedge that makes up 90% of the screen. If this makes up, what most individuals have to deal with, the job is just that extra slab on top. It's that extra 10% that can maybe fill your cup a little bit too much. So I think for me, the lack of sleep, the stressful nature of what we do, it was playing a factor, but I think it had a lot more to do with all the other stuff going on. So that's what just like you mentioned, the way I would communicate to someone is just using myself and my experience is like, I think that yes, the job played a factor, but I think there was a lot else going on in my life that was playing a much bigger role in why I was feeling that way. So if you're just going at it of that approach of, managing and working through the things that you experience at work, then I think there's a lot of untapped potential and there's a lot that we need to investigate further that isn't being looked into. And this is something that I think a way of framing things that they use a lot in the trauma space is like, me as a firefighter going to something horrific, that would be considered like a big T trauma. It's a big, highly, fueled experience. There's a lot of stimulus. There's a lot of sensory input because it's a very, acute scenario. But there's also what they refer to as like little T trauma, which is like, trauma isn't just the nasty, horrific stuff. Trauma could be how you were treated in school. Did people make fun of the color of your hair? Did you get bullied? Did you maybe not have as much as the other kids? Did you wish you looked a certain way? And that stuff, that stuff adds up over time. So we need to understand that. And I think people think, having a difficult past means that you grew up in the foster care system and you were abused and all that kind of stuff. But it's much more than that. There's all this little stuff that basically creates the self, the person you are. And until we sort of really start to look at that, I don't think we're really, getting to the root cause of maybe why you're having this unease. So it's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing to explain to people. But I just think awareness and at least getting them thinking of like, hey, wait a minute. Like, yeah, there was some stuff in my past that maybe makes me more prone to feel this way. Or, it's hard. It's hard, especially, in a work environment that is very, hyper-masculine, alpha, show no weakness. And again, that's why it's just like, hey, I'm going to say it how it is. I could be completely incorrect and you could disagree with every single thing that I'm saying. But again, if there's that one person out there that is maybe, you know, new to the job, is experiencing these things and is having those doubts, is asking those questions, if it helps them, then, you know, it's worth it for me.
Well, and I think, you know, a couple of the things that you're talking about too is one, I agree. I mean, unfortunately, we view trauma as this like extraordinary event that should be so obvious to us. And I think the point is, it doesn't have to be obvious. It could be something subtle that made you feel in a way that you sat with, and subconsciously, even you didn't even have to be aware of it. And then it's all the innuendos that kind of add to that and pile it on. And I think that, again, by nature, first responders, we're fix-it people. Like, we are people who want to fix a situation, and that's detrimental sometimes to a lot of things in life that aren't unique to first response, because ultimately there's a lot of things in life we can't fix. There's a lot of things in life that at the end of the day, you can contribute, you can show up, you can ultimately do what you can, but a lot of it is just sitting with it. A lot of it is the accepting what it is you've been handed. And it's ironic because, you know, I think that there's such an interesting conversation here that I'm sure we could go on for hours about, around, you know, what's the cause and the effect. And ultimately, I mean, coming into firefighting for me, I got into this later in life, and I got into this after years of living with depression and anxiety outwardly. I mean, this is, this isn't new to anybody. And everybody was kind of like, what are you thinking? What are you doing? Like, do you see your diagnosis? Do you see your story, your history? Like, how is that, how is it a good idea for you to get into first response? And where I very much align and agree with you is, it's not about, you know, that portion of how much of it is caused by. I think it's about the resilience we build and our ability to navigate situations and deal with things as they come up. And that was kind of something that I prided myself in, because when I was asked the question, how are you going to be an effective first responder living with anxiety and panic and depression? And at the end of the day, my answer was simple. I practice these things every day, and I have been for so long now. For so long, I've had to practice how I manage how things make me feel, or how overwhelming something is, or how much of a struggle something can be mentally. And I think that it's something that, exactly a testament to what you were saying in terms of building mental fitness and resiliency before the job, and why that's so important, is because it's those are the basis, those are the foundational pillars that allow us longevity in this line of work, I think. Because if you don't build yourself up for success, if you don't open yourself up to support when you need it, and be open to the fact that it might not be something that you can always compartmentalize, not necessarily because of the job, but because ultimately that piled on top of your life experience, which isn't unique to any of us. We all, none of us gets through life without grief, without complexity, without hardship. And when you add those things to what we do and what we experience at work, I think it's just, it's a failure to not put in the work to figure out how to best support ourselves and one another. And I think that that's what's so important about the approach that you take to fitness and wellness, is it's such a holistic approach, and it allows somebody to better themselves, not just physically to be able to manage the job, but also emotionally and mentally and preventatively. And, and I think that that's something that a lot of people need to look into, that we don't put enough emphasis in.
Yeah. And I think we, you know, I go back to this over and over again, because I think it's so important. And, you know, post-traumatic stress is talked about so often, but like, there's something that is very well studied and understood, which is post-traumatic growth. And like, all the things that I experienced as an individual that have been difficult, as a firefighter that's been difficult, at the time it was hard, at the time I wish I wasn't going through it, but every single thing that I've gone through has added so much more meaning to my life, has given me such greater perspective, has, you know, given me such, you know, so much more gratitude. Mm-hmm. So we need to understand is like, yes, it's hard. Yes, it's difficult, but everything that happened in the past, everything that's happened in my career has built me up into this person. And I love this concept that I've heard, you know, a couple of times is if you were trying to create a great person who is going to do great things and, you know, shine their light upon the world, what kind of existence would you have that person go through?
Yeah.
Would you make it something that was very easy without trials and tribulations and hardship and, you know, sorrow and grief? No, man, you would have that person go through hell and back twice because you know this, you know, fortified version of that person that would come out on the other side. That would be, you know, more understanding, more sympathetic, more empathetic, all those great things that we ultimately need to experience hardship in order to gain. Like that stuff doesn't just come along. So, awareness and understanding, but also constantly circling back, you know, to that side of there's such value and there's such, you know, beauty in the struggle. And I know it in the moment, the person that's in the depths right now is hearing this being like, that guy has no idea what he's talking about. Yeah. But I can tell you the person I was 4 years ago and the person I was today through consistent effort and just trying to get not even 1% better every day, trying to get a fraction of a percent better every day. Ultimately, that has compounded into me being where I'm at today, where that imposter syndrome kicks in to be like, I cannot even believe the man looking back at me in the mirror, because 4 years ago, if you asked me if I would be who I am today, I would say heck no. And that's why when I talk to other individuals, it's like, just keep going, because if you do, it's going to compound over time and you have no idea of how you can spin what you've been through into, you know, potentially the greatest thing that's ever happened to you, which sounds crazy, but that is a narrative that has, you know, repeated itself over and over in history. That look at the most successful people, the Tony Robbins of the world, all these people, listen to their story and it'll really open your eyes.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. And I, you know, I'm so grateful that we crossed paths in life, and I do. You're one of my favorite people to watch kind of your journey in terms of how it's going. And I remember you 4 years ago, and I remember, you know, some of the conversations we had and some of the anxiety you were feeling, and was grateful you trusted me with that. But to see just kind of that journey, it's been incredible. I just, you know, real quick, couple of quick things. So, you know, just to, I think the thing I appreciate most about you and why I want to, you know, make sure everybody is keeping an eye on you is it's not just talk. And I think that that's huge as well. You're somebody who leads by action. You just completed an Ironman for fun, because that's what people do when they don't have enough on their plates. And it's always amazing.
As a 200-pound, 5'10" meathead that definitely had no place being there. Yeah, I definitely stuck out like a sore thumb, that's for sure.
And absolutely blew it away. And I mean, anybody who knows you is proud of you for watching it. And I mean, so just quick question, what's next? You know, what can people expect next from you?
I can't really disclose that. I'm really looking forward to having the opportunity of disclosing that. It is in relation to firefighting and endurance.
Yeah, I'm glad I went this way, because I might have just spilled the beans, right?
For sure. No, it is good. It definitely is in relation to firefighting and endurance sport. It's something that I've wanted to do for a while now. It's something that is, you know, so much bigger than me, and I'm so prepared because I know it's gonna be really hard. And like we were already talking, I love things because when it gets hard, I know that there's some valuable nuggets in there.
Yeah.
And it will be within the next 6 months, hopefully. Early late spring next year is kind of the timeline.
You know what? Let's call this part two. I'm reserving the right to bring you
for
back.
Sure.
We are
for
gonna
sure.
talk no, about this. I'm excited because I might know a little bit about The Secret, but we'll just, you know what? I think it's incredible. And I think it's going to be a journey that everybody should follow. We will definitely, and off air, we'll have some further conversations because I've also made some headway in terms of
cool.
some information that could help you along the way. So, Mitch, I appreciate your time. I appreciate you. If you haven't, his links will be in the podcast description. But Everyday Fitness, you're just such a great guy.
Appreciate
Everyday
that.
Everyday Heroes. Well, sorry. And there I am. Like, I'm like, what's the actual address? I don't have it off the top of my head.
Everydayheroes.fitness.
Why I was getting it all mixed up.
Yeah, there. I know. Apparently there's another, I think there must be another Everyday Heroes Fitness out there.
The handle
was taken, but yeah, Kendra, it was an absolute pleasure to chat. And like I mentioned earlier, if there's one person out there that is, you know, breathing easier because of this conversation today, then it was absolutely worth it. So I can't wait to get back for part two. And if everything goes as planned, I think we'll have a whole lot to talk about.
Oh, it's happening. It's
second
happening.
Time around.
You know what? I will be however big of a part of it you let me be. But either way, if I'm just spectating, I'll be there cheering you on.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining me today, Mitch. And look forward to you talking again soon.
Awesome. Take care, guys.
Thanks for hanging out with us on another episode of Speakeasy, where we believe conversations are meant to be had out loud. Share this episode to help others find our show, and don't forget to rate and review on Apple Podcasts. You can also join me at KFisher30 on Instagram as I travel across Canada and the US tackling the current mental health crisis with colleges and universities.